Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity podcast. It is August 2nd, 2016, and I've got a very special podcast for you today. Each year, there's one book that stands out for me that I will recommend widely and often. And I think this year's winner has already emerged, even though 5 months still remain. And we're going to talk to the author of that book today. But first, I want to tell you my criteria for book of the year. First, I have to learn something beyond interesting into the realm of what I'll call important. And second, this book has to explain something about which I've been curious, but lacked a good way of understanding it. And third, the book has to change the way I think about the world, as in never quite the same afterwards, and maybe even entirely differently. Now, that might sound like a pretty tall order, but we live in a big, amazing, expanding world, and the challenge for the truly curious is in figuring out how to pare the list down and select from among the many excellent options out there. The book we're going to discuss is Why Nations Fail, and it addresses a question that has long stumped, well, pretty much everybody, which is why some nations are prosperous and some are poor. Now, there have been a lot of attempts at answering that question, and factors such as culture, geography, weather, resources have each been promoted as the deciding one. Why Nations Fail takes a completely fresh look at the question and comes up with a rather surprising answer. To speak with us is one of the authors, Daron Acemoglu, who co-authored the book with James Robinson, himself a Harvard economist. And Daron is the Killian Professor of Economics at MIT, and in 2005, he received the John Bates Clark Medal, awarded to economists under 40, judged to have made the most significant contribution to economic thought and knowledge. Welcome, Daron.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to be here. And can I hire you as my publicist for the next book?
Absolutely. But wait, let's see how the interview goes first. You may change your mind.
All right.
I hope not. But let's start, Daron, if we could, right at the top. We really broad outlines for people listening. Some nations are rich, some are poor. Your book has a rather concise summary of why that is. What is it?
So, you know, as you indicated in your introduction, people have come up with all sorts of reasons. But ours is actually extremely simple. We say it depends on incentives and opportunities. If people have opportunities to become rich, to open businesses, be innovative, do things that are going to further their interests, and at the same time, the nation's GDP, gross domestic product, and they have incentives to do so, that's going to lay the foundations of economic prosperity. Sounds extremely simple, but the thing is that most nations don't provide those sorts of opportunities and incentives to their citizens. And therein lies the sort of the big divide. How do we summarize those opportunities and incentives? Well, we sort of use the word institutions, the rules, formal and informal regulations, organization of society that determines what sort of opportunities are available to different people, to people from different walks of lives, and what sorts of incentives they function under.
So let's talk about that for a bit, because here's what really struck me, the piece that really crystallized for me in your book is this idea that we really have to understand the institutions, as you just mentioned, the political and the economic institutions. So let's get specific about this. Latin America versus, say, Canada and the United States, seemingly both with good geographic positioning, both with natural resources, but very different trajectories. What was it about the institutions, say, in Latin America that you would say begin to help us understand why there have been such different outcomes for these two areas?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of my favorite examples also, because it is in some ways easier to understand because institutions both in the south and the north of the continent are shaped by their colonization experiences. You know, when the Europeans arrive at the end of the 15th century, you know, there are some notable differences within the continent, but nowhere of the order of magnitude we observe today. There are some civilizations in the south, in particular, the Aztecs and the Incas, that are much more complex, more developed, and nothing of the sort in the north. But the living standards are not hugely different. But then you have, for reasons we can get into in a second, but let me give you the brief answer. We have that very different sets of institutions are imposed on the areas that make up Latin America today, what we call extractive institutions. And extractive institutions are the name we give to those that are designed in such a way that they extract resources from the mass of society for the benefit of the politically powerful, the elite. So in particular, you have extractive economic institutions, things like the encomienda system, for example, the forced labor system, the land grant system, other forced labor systems that essentially put the indigenous people to work for the benefit of the European colonialists, the Spanish colonialists in particular, that colonized most of Latin America. And these are in turn supported by what we call extractive political institutions, a political system that concentrates power in the hands of the same people who are benefiting from the same economic institutions, and does not introduce any sorts of checks and balances or constraints coming from society on the exercise of that power. For reasons that have very little to do with the good-hearted or enlightened nature of the English who colonized the North, very different sorts of institutions developed in the north. It has very little to do with their enlightened nature, because the English wanted to emulate the Spanish and wanted to do exactly the same thing, but they failed. And instead, you have what we call inclusive economic institutions, supported by inclusive political institutions, emerging in the north. So inclusive economic institutions, for instance, their basis is private property in land, which sort of gets introduced at the beginning of the 17th century. No such thing existed in the English colonies or colonial attempts before, and in the Spanish realm, because everything was the crown's property. And that private property in land introduced sort of incentives and opportunities for small landholders to sort of improve their productivity, work for their own benefit. And crucially, that whole system got to be supported by what we call inclusive political institutions. And the same name for the economic and the political legs of this is no coincidence, because we want to emphasize that extractive economic and political institutions generally tend to go together, and inclusive economic and political institutions also generally go together. And the inclusive political institutions were much more self-governing institutions, such as assemblies at the local level, culminating in national institutions, of course, after the Articles of Confederation and the U.S. Constitution and so on. And they opened the path to very different development experiences. If you look at the development of Latin America, for example, Mexico or Peru, such as it is, because there wasn't much of economic growth or economic development for long periods of time, it's very much based on monopoly. It's very much, grants given by whoever is politically powerful, either agents of the Spanish crown or generals who were ruling the colonies at the time. And then people who get these opportunities are very much the privileged, and they exploit it as monopolists generally do. And there is very little sort of ability for the common folk to sort of take part in economic activities and rise up. And you contrast that to the United States, especially in the northeast of the United States, you see a very vibrant economic scene where people, regardless of which walk of life they come in, are able to jump in. They become entrepreneurs, they become innovators, they become owners of factories, exporters, commercial sort of men. And that sort of fuels a technology-based, productivity-based economic growth, which is, of course, defining for the 19th century and then later 20th century U.S. economic growth.
Now, if I have this story right, you're saying that to understand, say, Peru today, or anybody, not to pick on Peru, but anybody in Latin America, we have to go back to the 1500s, because we need to understand the original system that was birthed in that moment. And as I understand it from your book, which really caught me, was this idea that there was this highly extractive model that was being run. This is what the Spaniards understood in the 1500s and the Portuguese. And they would go to a place, of course, extract all the gold and silver that was available. That's fine. But once that's done, the resource was human capital that could be used to farm. And so they would allow, if I could, you know, paint with a broad brush, allow enough of the farming produce to exist with the populace so they basically could reproduce and not die. But the rest, the surplus, would be harvested off. And that was the model. So it was a highly extractive model, which gave no individual property rights, no incentives for personal development, no incentives even for necessarily bringing in new technology. The model was really just one that extracted the labor of humans, and that's what they understood. Is that fair?
So that's an excellent summary. And the key thing is exactly like you say, you know, these extractive systems have very little inducement for people, for society to increase its productivity. And you see that, you know, in places like Barbados, which were based on an extreme version of the system you described, you know, slavery. Or you see that even in the U.S. South before the Civil War, and to some degree even after the Civil War, you know, even when these places are economically thriving, for example, the Caribbean plantation colonies such as, you know, Barbados, Cuba, Haiti, they did extremely well for a while because sugar was a very, very valuable commodity in the world. And U.S. South did very well, cotton, tobacco. But even during that period, they had very little in terms of productivity improvements, very, very, very little in terms of innovations. And as a result, you know, even if they could generate some surplus, that did not translate into economic growth. In fact, it was worse than that. Many of these societies, and again, U.S. South is an example, but not the most extreme one, they were so worried, and rightly so, about controlling the slaves, controlling the people who were doing the production under, you know, repression and under the threat of a gun, that they did not even want to teach them anything. You know, in many of the Caribbean plantation colonies, it was illegal to teach how to read and write to the slaves. And, you know, if you look at it with our own eyes, where human capital, the capability of workers to actually understand what they're doing and improve over it is so crucial, you know, it's going to be no surprise that these places are not going to do very well economically, especially in the long run.
Now, that critical bit of difference, though, that I loved in that book where you described where there was a culture that sort of was allowed, if I can use that term, for the Spaniards to come in and have their way. But at Jamestown, the Virginia Company was coming in and wanted to run that same model. I think you alluded to that earlier. They weren't any more enlightened, I think you said. They said, hey, here's a model. You go in. There are people living there. See if you can set up this extractive system. And that's what they were first thinking to do. Is that not right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, and how could it be different? Look at it this way. You know, even though they killed, some estimates suggest, up to 90% of the population because of diseases and various other things, you know, from their viewpoint, what the Spaniards were doing was a huge success. You know, the Spanish Empire was thriving, was the strongest in the world. Its coffers were full with silver. Its you know, agents, its captains and colonialists in the Americas were extremely powerful and prosperous. And everybody wanted to emulate them. Everybody was competing. That's why European powers started fighting, because they all wanted to have part of the loot. And when the English, you know, ended up with their own sort of part of the colonial world, the North, which actually wasn't so great from their viewpoint, because everybody wanted the South. The North were like sort of the leftovers. But no matter, what they wanted to do was exactly what the Spaniards did. So they emulated them. So the Virginia Company, founded in 1607, you know, had a slightly different model. It wasn't a crown monopoly, but it sort of sold its shares to people in London, and people were willing to, you know, put a lot of money in the Virginia company because they thought, look, these guys are doing what the Spaniards did, and they're going to make money just like the Spaniard, like the Spanish crown did. So we want to have a piece of it. And then the Virginia company, you know, gets these funds, sends three ships to, you know, to the north of the United States. It turns out, you know, the thing that they had targeted was Jamestown, which is like an island off Virginia, like seemed like a good place to start. But, you know, things didn't work out that way because they couldn't find anybody to do the work for them. So their model was just go and overpower whoever we're going to find, just like the Spaniards overpowered the Aztecs or the Incas, put them to work, take their gold and silver, but more importantly, as you said, make them work for your benefit. Well, there's nobody there, or there's only these, you know, hunter-gatherers, very sparsely settled mobile Indians, and they're not going to do your bidding for you. And so there's an impasse. They come up with the idea of bringing people from Europe. You know, there are lots of poor people in Europe at the time. You know, this is before the Industrial Revolution. Population is increasing and not that much more productivity. So they collect people. It's a costly voyage for them. They bring them there. They're going to be the people, the sort of the lower strata of society, you know, doing the production for the benefits of the governors and the soldiers and the elite of the Jamestown colony and the owners of the Virginia Company. But these people, as soon as they come in, they say, no, we're not going to be repressed like this. They start running to the Indians, or they start just going off by themselves. And that's when Virginia Company realizes, look, we're just not going to be able to replicate what the Spaniards did, because the conditions in the north are different than the south. Just the population density and the complex civilizations we could take over are not there. And so that's when they throw in the towel and they introduce things like the private property rights and the general assemblies that I hinted at before.
And if they had found a large subjugatable population, your argument is, of course, history is entirely different, because then they just replicate the model and
exactly. That's what they did in India. That shows that it's not really, you know, the sort of the enlightened values of the British. When the British, colonized India, that, you know, India in some sense was even a more complex and more densely settled place. They adopted a colonization strategy very similar, based on military might. They fought many wars against the Indians and subjugated them. And their colonization strategy, although the details differed a little bit because this is happening, you know, 200 years later and the terrain is different, but in its broad outlines, it's very similar to what the Spaniards and the Portuguese did in South America.
Yes. Yeah, so the emerging pattern here then is that when individuals are properly incentivized, you can have things like rapid increases in productivity and bursts of creativity that come through a new technology and other things like that. That the story of history is really one of fairly minor differences a long time ago, resulting in these wildly different emergent behaviors. But that when we parse back through that, we can see that the piece that's really seems to be the critical bit here is that unless individuals are appropriately incentivized, whatever system you install around them either has a limit it can't get beyond or is just destined to fail at some point.
Absolutely. So if I could paraphrase what you've said, you know, our thesis is that everywhere, geographically and historically, what matters are the institutions and the incentives that they create. So if you want to understand, you know, modern day Egypt or North Korea or France or Argentina, you know, you have to look at how their institutions are structured today and what sorts of incentives, what sort of opportunities they provide to their population. But in many cases, not every, but in many cases, those institutions are shaped historically. They go back to a time where small differences during critical periods, what we sometimes call critical junctures, created some cumulative process of institutional divergence between many of these societies, and that's where we see their sort of institutions being shaped. And so that's why we have to look at the historical process institutional formation. So you cannot understand modern day Mexico, you cannot understand modern day Haiti, you cannot understand modern day United States without looking at, you know, how things worked out in the first 100 years or so after their sort of modern history started with the colonization attempts. But if you want to think about, say, European nations, you know, their histories, of course, were not shaped just in the last 5 years. You have to go back even further to 12th century, 11th century, perhaps even earlier. But, you know, for some other cases, there are, you know, key events that have taken place over the last 60, 70 years. You know, the example we sort of talk about in the early chapters of the book is South versus North Korea, where a fairly homogeneous nation is suddenly broken into two at the 38th parallel because of, you know, a deal between China, Russia, and the United States. And now you create, during that, their own critical juncture, two societies that are so different, and then you see them diverge because their institutions are so divergent.
And those critical junctures, of course, history is littered with them, and no guarantees, right? If you approach one, that you'll go to the north or to the south in the Korean
example.
Right,
that's where human agency matters a lot. Small differences matter. You know, the key characters matter. You know, sometimes leadership plays a central role. And, you know, the other thing that we do emphasize in the book, but perhaps we should have emphasized even more, you know, given the situation that the world is in right now, is, you know, you can even more quickly destroy inclusive institutions than you can build them. So we give the example of Venice, which, you know, had some of the most sophisticated and inclusive institutions of the Middle Ages, but then, you know, they totally sort of turned them into oligarchic extractive structures, and so their economic fortunes reverse. So that sort of pattern is unfortunately all too common in history too.
Well, this is a really important area that I want to turn to now, because, you know, good theory has great explanatory power. I love your theory of development, and because a lot of things just click for me. That's one of my tests for a good theory, is like, things begin to make more sense now. But a good framework can have that predictor. So I'd like to turn now to how we might map your work's explanatory and maybe predictive power onto these current events, specifically. What if we think of rich versus poor nations not as, you know, a binary toggle switch that's either on or off, you know, it's either true or false, but instead it's a smooth dial, and it can stop at any point along a continuum spanning the very poorest nation to the very wealthiest? Do current events in the United States, in your view, support the idea that core concepts of building towards more inclusive economic and political institutions, which way is that dial turning? Are we heading towards the wealthy side or the other side? Does your framework, you know, map into current events like that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it does. But of course, you know, you're always taking chances when you try to sort of comment on events that are unfolding as we speak. But, you know, I mean, if you want to summarize what we say about the United States in the book, a fair summary would be, you know, U.S. is an example of inclusive economic and political institutions, but it's always had its own challenges, you know, starting with slavery, you know, then building up to great inequality, both economic and political, during the Gilded Age, which, you know, saw, you know, robber barons and huge monopolization of American business. Then, you know, segregation and still sort of sidelining of a significant fraction of U.S. population in terms of economic opportunities. All of these, you know, are sort of extractive elements. So, you know, the, you know, emphasizing that it's a gray sort of, nothing is black and white. So even though U.S. is broadly inclusive, there are, it has these very problematic areas, it has these very extractive elements within its institutional framework. But what it has done until now is it has, not smoothly, but after some struggle, after some back and forth, has been able to solve some of the major problems that it was facing. So it sort of got rid of slavery, enfranchised African Americans, then, you know, dealt with the issues of monopolization of business and their political influences, then, you know, during civil rights, you know, extended opportunities more broadly within society, both to blacks and then earlier to women also, or an ongoing process to women. But today, I think we are facing an entirely new set of challenges, And I think it's still unclear whether we are going to be able to rise up to these challenges. And I would, in particular, highlight, you know, two areas, although I think one could add to these. One area that I would highlight is that the entire world, but also the United States in particular, is in the midst of another economic revolution. New technologies and globalization providing huge opportunities for increasing our productivity, increasing our ability to produce goods economically and a variety, increase the variety of goods that we produce for our consumers. But these opportunities are also creating very unequal gains. You know, globalization, for example, our trade with less developed economies such as China are reducing labor costs, but in the process destroying a lot of jobs, and these gains that say that accrue to sort of companies or some subset of consumers are not really necessarily automatically spreading to the rest of society. The problem is even more dire when you come to new technologies such as artificial intelligence, robots, you know, which are coming online right now, but you know, over the last 25 years, we have a broader process of automation going on, which again took a lot of jobs and made them more efficient, but in the process created both unemployment and, you know, downward pressure on the wages of a significant fraction of Americans. So all of these are creating challenges about how do we take the gains that are being created by this amazing globalization and technological changes and make sure that that rising tide lifts all boats, both in terms of gains so that we don't create huge inequalities and therefore huge discontent within society, and also importantly in terms of opportunities so that we don't destroy the relatively level playing field that the United States has compared to other countries. So that's the first challenge. The second challenge, perhaps not unrelated, is that every society continuously struggles with limiting political inequality. Politically inclusive institutions, which I mentioned earlier on, they rest on the premise that no single individual or no group of individuals is going to become so powerful as to dictate the political choices of society. One person, one vote, one person, one voice. Of course, you know, it's not going to be perfect, but broad distribution of political power. Well, that's never true in any society, but it also becomes harder and harder sometimes as certain groups, certain individuals start accumulating more political power. You know, I mentioned Venice. That's how the decline of Venice started. Some people said, okay, we're going to monopolize the Venetian parliament. We're going to not allow other people to come in and become politically powerful actors in this society. And then the whole thing unraveled. So in the United States, we have the same thing coming from the fact that, you know, money matters a lot in politics. A lot of people have become disinterested in politics. A lot of people don't have their voices heard in politics. And I think, you know, how do we create the institutional structures to make sure that society maintains its economic vibrancy while at the same time the economic inequalities that are inevitable in an age of major economic transformations, so we make sure that they don't translate into huge political inequalities.
Now, Daron, as you wrote here on page 113, and I'm speaking to your probably a little bit to the first and the second challenges you just mentioned, you wrote here that in Venice, they ultimately transform themselves into extractive institutions under the control of a narrow elite that monopolize both economic opportunities and political power. You know, it was a number of years ago, I was interviewing a senator and noted that 90% of the letters they had received at the time in 2008 had been heavily against the idea of bank bailouts. And yet, of course, we had bank bailouts. And so this is one of the key pieces that I'm feeling at this point in time. You talk about the economic and political inequality. It really seems that this statement you said about a narrow elite beginning to monopolize both the economic and political power, that's the part, at least in the financialization of our economy, that most, I think, is obvious at this point in terms of being fairly extractive and non-inclusive.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, the zenith of this came this year when, Sheldon Adelson made Republican presidential hopefuls come to his home and, make sure that they all, swore their allegiance to his policy agenda. I mean, how can that be true in a politically inclusive society?
Well, that's a pretty obvious example with Sheldon. But that same story is being played out, I think, very aggressively across the political landscape at this point.
Absolutely. No, it's not. I mean, I certainly didn't mean that this is specific to Republicans. I think Sheldon Adelson is an extreme case, but the same is true for Democrats. So two political scientists, Martin Gillens and what's his name? Now I'm blocking. Bartels, Larry Bartels, separate works have been sort of looking at the landscape of political power in U.S. society, and they both, using different methods, conclude that both for the Republicans and Democrats, and mostly looking at senators and congressmen, they have become much more responsive to the wishes of their wealthier, better, more affluent constituents. So it's not like this is, a problem for Republicans and not for Democrats. It's true across the board.
Now, this is why I think that if I could characterize them as more youthful, that the Bernie supporters, but especially the new generations, really need to read this book, because what you're describing here is that it's not like you're either a rich nation or you're a poor nation. The United States has made it to some exclusive club to which it has permanent pass to, or any other nation, but rather that at any moment in time, it really matters what's happening with your institutions and whether they're drifting towards openness, fairness, freedom, inclusiveness, or whether they're drifting in the other direction. I think this is a really keen point that has to be understood, because it's really important, right? This is
absolutely,
really important.
Absolutely. I think you've put it so well. And then I think it's even more sort of urgent in some sense, because even though, you can, any society, especially when it starts with relatively inclusive political and economic institutions such as the United States, can tolerate some deterioration in its institutions, they might reach such a point that it would be very difficult to reverse them. United States, U.S. politics became very, very poisoned at the beginning of the 20th century. For example, many people thought, the Senate, for example, which was not directly elected at the time, was in the pockets of the robber barons. But before the whole thing lost its legitimacy and started disintegrating, there were major reforms, under Teddy Roosevelt, Taft, and then Wilson, and the whole thing sort of recovered. But, unless you took that sort of action, it might have continued to deteriorate, and then at some point you might reach a point of no return. So we can't rest on our laurels. We are a great society. We have prosperity, we have freedom, we have innovation, we have a horizon of new ideas and entrepreneurship and risk-taking that's just absolutely, great from the viewpoint of creating economic gains and social gains. But the whole thing could collapse unless we really tackle these two areas that are, I think, so central for the future of our institutions.
I thoroughly agree. That was very well said. I want to see if there's a third piece to this. I do want to turn to resources if we can, because I do a lot of research on resource depletion. And so here's the thing. I can't help but notice, Daron, that the wealth of the rich nations is it's really also based on an extractive model, but instead of extractive political and economic institutions that are aimed at individuals, they're nonetheless highly extractive, but of natural systems and resources. So the extraction is merely been placed somewhere else in this story instead of right on humans is what I'm saying. So the question for you, is it possible in your view that the wealthy nations may end up winning the race but losing the contest, as it were?
Right. So, I mean, you know, so if I could go back 1 second or one step, what I would say is that, you know, we certainly did not intend to, and hopefully we did not write a morality play. It's not like inclusive institutions or societies that support inclusive institutions are superior in some general sense. Inclusive institutions are only as good as the people who are included. So British institutions were already very inclusive and were becoming much more inclusive in the 19th century. But during that period, you know, Britain was also a, you know, vicious colonial power in India and parts of Africa. How come? Well, the people who are included, they had voice, they could defend themselves, they could get better and better opportunities, but the people in the colonies did not, were not included, and they would not benefit from the sort of same treatment. Well, the environment more broadly, not just the resources that we draw from the ground, but, you know, the environment more broadly, that's until very, very recently, that of course did not have any voice. So we could be a very inclusive system. We could look after each other's interests and nobody would be, you know, repressed and exploited because we have this broadly distributed political power, but we could all gang together and, you know, damage the environment and damage indirectly the future generations who are not born and therefore don't have the voice. But, you know, the political system and the technocrats have been pointing out for the last, you know, 30 years about the problems of damaging the environment with pollution, with carbon emissions, and so on. And I think that's sort of dawning on people, and many societies are realizing that they're really jeopardizing their future with this sort of the current growth trajectory. And there is some movement towards dealing with this issue. And I think the solution is not sort of the Club of Rome type of sacrifice growth. I think exactly the same elements that underpinned rapid growth in the 19th and the 20th centuries in Western Europe, in the United States, is the solution to our environmental problems. Develop better technologies that are greener, that are cleaner, that don't do the same sort of damage, but the transition to those technologies is costly. And the problem is that I think that's quite feasible, but it's made difficult by the fact that the problems we're facing are not national, but they're global, and we have no global governance to deal with these issues.
Well, absolutely, and your book is nothing if it's not just a complete tour of all the ways that humans will be humans, and that given the opportunity to consolidate power and act in ways that are extractive and non-distributive, it seems to be an easy path for people to end up going down. The way I connect that here is that when we're talking about something that's global, like let's say we get concerned about carbon levels, let's say that we decide that the 800 quadrillion BTUs of fossil fuels we're burning every year needs to be dialed back to some other number, 600 or less or something. Getting that to be done is going to be one of the largest political challenges I can possibly imagine. Is there, in your mind, do you think, are you calling for the idea that we need to have institutions that can span these geographies that could handle that sort of request, if that was the request being made? Or is there a way that we can sort this through market forces and local incentives?
Well, I think neither. I mean, you know, I think it's totally infeasible to have global institutions with the power to compel, you know, participants such as China, the United States, and India to do what they don't want to do. You know, for a while, I was optimistic that perhaps, you know, you could have supranational institutions that are, you know, not as wide in terms of their coverage, but say at the European level, but we're seeing how that is crumbling in front of our eyes at the moment. So I think building supranational institutions institutions is very difficult. You know, we'll see what the future of Europe will hold, but certainly I think extending that to the whole world is not something that's on the cards for the near future. And I think we cannot just do it with market incentives. I want to correct that. So I didn't mean it that way. We cannot just do it with unfettered, unregulated markets. I think if at the moment the government does nothing in terms of carbon taxes or regulation, you know, businesses naturally and justifiably are just going to go to the most profitable technologies, which are the existing carbon-based technologies. So I think the solution is a market-based one to provide incentives to firms and businesses to transition to cleaner technology. And it's something that the businesses themselves will have to do, but the governments have to play a role in setting prices for carbon, in setting incentives for the right sort of R&D, so that, you know, the better vintage of clean technologies can be built. But in the absence of these global institutions, that has to be done voluntarily with different countries selfishly coming together. So finding a common ground between the United States, China, and India, as well as Europe.
Interesting. Yeah. So the, you know, there's another body of work that I've been tracking, which is the role of energy in human history. And it's just a different orthogonal view of this whole thing. But this is the challenge I'm intrigued. This is why that your book really caught me, is I'm really struggling with the idea of what are the right institutions to manage this transition. And Darren, the way I look at it through the energy lens says that humans went from wood to coal. We went from a less dense to a more dense, higher quality energy source. And we went from coal to oil, or also nuclear. Again, we made the jump from a less dense to a more dense, just a more wonderfully concentrated energy source. The next transition that you're talking about is a step back down that ladder. It's going from a more dense to a more diffuse energy source, whether it's solar, wind, or whatever. Those are more diffuse. That the capital costs involved in going backwards on that, just from a physics standpoint, is extraordinary. And so there'll be a lot of behavioral changes, a lot of convincing to have people do, but the fossil fuels are the easy button. Hitting these alternative technologies is going to be a much more complex, not undoable, but certainly a much more complex challenge that will require a lot of a thoughtful rather than an easy response.
Absolutely. I agree with all of that. But the only silver lining is that even without major incentives, you see consumers in Europe and also to some degree in the United States doing lots of things in order to facilitate that transition, going towards clean energy in their houses, going towards hybrid vehicles. Recycling is like a huge success for, you know, that's essentially consumer driven. So I think that's the only silver lining, that, you know, it seems like in some sense, at least a significant part of the population in the developed world is ahead of its politicians.
Interesting. Well, let's keep our fingers crossed for more of that. And for everybody listening, the book is Why Nations Fail. It's brilliant. It's readable. It's my book of the year. And if you read it, it will make you smarter, and it's going to change how you see the world. It's really been a treat to read, and I can't recommend it highly enough. I already have. So thank you, Professor Acemoglu. It's been so great talking with you, and all the best. And I hope this book just continues to sell well and go far.
Thanks very much, Chris. It's been my pleasure to talk to you, and hopefully we'll have a conversation about our next book also in the next few years.
Oh, I'd love to. Do you have another one on the way?
We're working on it, so it won't be out for another 2 years or so.
All right. Well, looking forward to it already.